afternoon. Welcome to this edition of Radio Linguistica. Our subject today are the Celts and their languages. We are very happy that we have a big specialist for these questions in DGT, our colleague Diarmuid Johnson, who is working, who is a translator in the Irish department. Diarmuid, could you present yourself? What have you studied, and tell us a little bit about your books as well.
Thank you very much, Conrad. I've been working in DGT for 3 years now. Previously, for a time, I pursued an academic career lecturing in Celtic language and literature, Welsh, Irish and Breton, both medieval and modern. So I've spent almost 20 years of my life, I suppose, in that pursuit. More recently then, the last 10 years, I've been writing intensely and publishing quite a lot. A recent project of mine is called Sraithne Tauraigh, or the Tara Trilogy, which is a retelling of the what we're calling the origin tales of Ireland. That project is has these three books have been published. We're hoping to translate and publish in other languages. And I have another project or two going at the moment, if you'd like to hear about those.
Of course. So, for example, I heard that you were writing a diary of St. Gallus, which is interesting me personally, because I've grown up at the Lake of Constance, where the Irish-Scottish monks founded a monastery, which is today World Heritage of UNESCO. And as a child, I didn't know anything but everybody about Ireland, Irish and Celtic, but everybody told all the time that the Irish-Scottish monks were very busy and active in our region and brought, so to say, culture and religion to us. So tell a little bit about your book on that subject.
The book I'm writing is to do with the beginning of the period you describe. It's an incredible story. It begins in Ireland, in the monastery of Bangor in County Down, either in the year 587 or 590. Good historians can never agree with each other. But anyway, St. Columbanus and 12 followers left Ireland on a peregrinatio pro deum, pilgrimage for Christ, to bring the faith to the heathens down there where you were brought up, Conrad, and bring the faith to your people. They did, and they spent 20 years in eastern France, working under the Merovingians, and then on the banks of Lake Constance. And Gallus in Latin, or Calloch in Irish, or St. Gall in English, and the town in Switzerland is named after him. And I'm writing his diary. So in his diary, from the year 590 to 610 or so, he describes the his travels and some of the things he saw, and this crucial period in the at the beginning of Christian Europe, what became Europe then as we know it, started about that time, really.
Well, thank you very much. You can tell us a little bit about, I found a map about the Celts in Europe, because actually the Celts at one time were everywhere in Europe, and we still have a lot of topographic names, especially rivers, which have Celtic names. So perhaps you could a little bit comment on this card.
Sure. Yes. Well, so as you say, At one time in history, so centuries, in the centuries leading up to the birth of Christ, Celtic languages were spoken widespreadly in Europe then. The tribes, the Celtic-speaking tribes, occupied an area which includes modern France and some of Germany and east, then through the into the Balkans and so on, as well as places on the Iberian Peninsula. So in a way, at that time, I suppose, 300 BC, 400, 500 BC, Celtic culture was the most important culture in Europe at the time, really. And there you have it in a nutshell.
Yes, and if I look at the map, I see even in today's Turkey, there were the Galati, to which actually St. Paul wrote a letter. So even in this part of, Europe or the Middle East, there were Celts.
That's right. So the Celtic, I suppose the Celtic people then gradually, their culture declined. It remained strong in Gaul until the time of Caesar, about the time of Christ, the first, second centuries of our era. The language and, different tribal cultures of Celtic-speaking peoples remained strong, but was assimilated then into the Roman way of life. Before the end of the Roman Empire, if the empire had collapsed slightly earlier, who knows? Perhaps Europe would still be Celtic speaking. You see, but
That are nice speculations, but actually we are not really Radio Historica here. We are Radio Linguistica, so we will focus on the languages. Let's have a look on the kinship, on the family of the Celtic languages.
So the Celtic languages belong to the family of Indo-European languages, and we speak of a common Celtic language which probably existed. It's a hypothesis, but as is Indo-European. But following this hypothesis, then we divide the Celtic languages into continental Celtic. These are the languages spoken during the classical era, the time of the Greek and Roman empires. And secondly, what we call insular Celtic. And insular Celtic is the family of languages spoken on the islands, those islands being Ireland and Britain. And so the insular Celtic languages, they comprise two branches of Celtic, and these branches are called Q Celtic and P Celtic. This is just a reference to phonological development. It's the history of the languages. The Q Celtic branch is Gaelic, and the P Celtic branch is Brythonic. And in the Q Celtic branch, then we have two or three variants of Gaelic, being depending on the place they were spoken. So Ireland, Irish, Scotland, Scots Gaelic, and Manx. Whereas for the P Celtic languages, we have variants according to territory as well. So Welsh in Wales, Cornish in Cornwall, and Breton in Brittany.
If I understood correctly, of the continental Celtic languages, nothing has remained.
The continental Celtic languages were spoken from the advent of the Celtic period until, at the very latest, I suppose, the 4th or 5th centuries AD, maybe in some pockets of Auvergne and southern Brittany, Gaulish may have survived.
Where Asterix and Obelix lived.
That's right, that's right. But the language, the Gaulish language, we know to the extent that inscriptions have been found on inscriptions, funerary inscriptions, perhaps, and also on pottery pieces. So short, there's no long text, but the short quotations. The oldest, as far as I know, the oldest document in Celtic is from Iberia. It's from a place called Botorita in Aragon. And that's quite a long text, actually. It's a plate. I'm not sure if it's bronze. So we have vestiges, you might say, vestiges from classical times of the continental Celtic languages.
Oh, yes. So they were written in which writing? In Latin letters, or how were they written?
They're written in a sort of a runic. It's not what you would call the Roman alphabet, but it's a sort of there are marks on the whatever material, stone or clay or bronze, which can be deciphered in light of the Roman alphabet, let's say.
And do you have perhaps an example for Q and P? What a word which is Q or starts with Q in one language, in one language group, and P in the other one?
Well, there's a whole list of them. Let me think now. The one usually quoted is Cam in Irish, which is pen in Welsh, and this means head. This is the word head in English. So Cam, or in old Irish, Cam and pen. So there's a whole list of them, you know. But that's only one of one aspect of comparative phonology. There are a whole list of other sounds which correspond from one language to another. But that's the one that the linguists have chosen, Q and P.
And then the Celtic languages have some grammatical, let's say, oddities or features. And features they share, for example, with the Semitic languages, that you declinate prepositions. For example, here you find Hebrew and compared with Irish and with English. So you see that there is a common feature. Perhaps you could comment a little bit on this.
Well, if you look at the Irish, so the preposition le means with, and to form a prepositional pronoun, so English to me, then rather than having two distinct words, we form a compound. So the pronoun is suffixed to the preposition. So if a similar phenomenon existed in English, instead of to me, you would have tum. And instead of to us, you'd have tus. And so on. It's a compound whereby the pronoun is suffixed and it loses its autonomous quality and its final vowel. So that's how that system works.
Yes, and that's the same system in Semitic languages where you also have le, which means to, and you add the personal pronoun or the pronoun suffix. So that's and then let's have a look on some basic words, how they are in the different Celtic languages. So perhaps you can help us to read them. Could you please give the next slide so that we can read the? So there we have some basic words in Irish.
I see. Yes.
Monks, Welsh, and so on. Perhaps let's take Irish and Welsh.
Irish and Welsh. So these words are, I'll read the following words from the list. First Irish and then Welsh. Mór, Máur, Beag, Bach, Leahan, Lladan, Cuil, Cíl, Ma, Da, Droch, Rug, Nu, Newydd, Ŵr, Ir, Og, Ieianc, Sian, Hen, Bawr, Byddar.
So you would say that an Irish speaker could understand a Welsh speaker or the other way round?
No, there's no mutual intelligibility between the languages on the spoken level. So depending on the reader's degree of experience, a certain amount of may be deciphered, but not to the untrained ear, or indeed to a trained ear. So the basic vocabulary, a percentage of the basic vocabulary is related. That's true. This is a feature. This is a common feature, shared vocabulary, basic vocabulary.
And which languages are intelligible? So of the inside the two families, P and Q, perhaps they are mutually intelligible.
Well, so within the Q family, it's all Gaelic, really. It's a question of terminology. You see, if we use the word Gaelic, it's all Gaelic. So it depends then on the period and the place and the person and the subject of speech. But until the 18th century, the dialects, the Scottish Gaelic, as spoken in mid-Scotland, was largely intelligible to people speaking Irish Gaelic in Eastern and mid-Ulster, for example. But what's happened is, you see, is that the languages have dried up and moved to the periphery. So those peripheries are now distant. So the Isle of Lewis is a vibrant Gaelic-speaking area in Scotland, but it's a very particular dialect, and so mutual intelligibility between peripheral dialects is more difficult than between a sort of a standard spoken language in the 18th century before the Great Union, which is now disintegrating.
So then let's look at some difficulties of pronunciation. There we have, for example, place name which is spelled CWMYSTWYTH. So how is this pronounced?
Well, a simple way of describing the system is to say that U, the sound U is written with W, and the sound U is written with Y. That's all. You can say that U and Y are vowels, if you like, if it helps. So that's how the sounds are written. The sounds are not different, so it's U, U. And here we have two words, in fact, but in place names they tend to be written together. So Cum is a valley, Cum.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second word is the name of a river, which is Ystwyth. So Cwm Ystwyth. Oh, I know the place very well. It's one of my favorite places in the world, actually. It's a charming place. I used to go swimming there in the river and
where
so
exactly?
It's if you go to the National Library of Wales in Aberystwyth and then and drive out the road a little bit and then take a turn right, after 3 or 4 miles, you'll find yourself in Cwm Ystwyth.
Mm. So as soon as we can travel again, we will go all to Cwm Ystwyth.
I'll bring you there, Cwm Ystwyth, yes.
And then in Wales, also in Wales, we have a very, very long railway station name. Perhaps you can do us the favor to read it for us, because it's famous for its length.
Well, this is a famous one. Everybody likes this one, you know. So this place name is, I can't read it. I don't need to read it. I know it. It says, Llan fair pwll gwyngill go gerllin robwll Llandus hilio go go go. Llan fair pwll gwyngill go gerllin robwll Llandus hilio go go go. But nobody uses that. So it's called Llanfair PG, in Wales, Llanfair, PG. So Llan is church, Mair is Mary, and then there are other elements which just describe the location of the church. It was by a whirlpool where the where a white not sure how much one of those a tree grows by a cave. There you are.
So we have looked a little bit at the Celtic languages now. We have still the topic of language policy, because we may be surprised that once upon a time Celtic languages were so extended and everywhere in Europe, and now it's only in the very outskirts of Ireland and Scotland. So here we have the situation in Ireland in 1800, nearly everywhere in Ireland, except in the extreme east, Irish was spoken, and then in the middle of the 19th century, it's only the west. And so perhaps you can comment a little bit on this in these maps.
So these maps here are I think they speak for themselves, don't they? So
yes.
Ireland was almost monolingually Irish until 1800. The Normans had spoken French for a while, and we had other long-term visitors, shall we say, in the urban centres, you know. But Irish was the language of Ireland, and this started to change for various reasons. I like to link it with two things, the influence of English and the crown, but also with the changes in Europe. So the demographical factors, which meant that a change was inevitable, perhaps, in Ireland. Although language change itself was not inevitable, but the inevitable changes brought about language change. So the agrarian system collapsed really in Ireland, and Irish has been declining ever since until the year 2000, as the maps show.
Well, now we have still a look on the current policy. Of course, this topic of Brexit, and in some way it seems that the Celtic parts of more Celtic parts of Great Britain, they are most opposed to Brexit. So perhaps you could comment a little bit on that.
Well, yes, Brexit, I believe, is an English project, they've had a certain success with it. Naturally, then, in other parts of Britain and Ireland, people have mixed views about it. Scotland is emerging now as an independent country. It's following the exact same path as Ireland did 100 years ago. It's a textbook. It's emerging as Ireland did 100 years ago. Wales is in trouble. We're too close to England. The country is small and has few resources, really. And Wales is in trouble, unfortunately. It's been taken over by the gutter press, the Murdoch press, peddling its filthy lies and so on. Welsh people have taken some of this on board, unfortunately. The situation in Brittany, in Armorica, which is now part of France, is, I've seen it happen myself. The Breton language has evaporated. Now, when I was there in the 80s, I could speak Breton to lots and lots of people, people aged 40 upwards, really. And I returned there 5 years ago, and the language has simply evaporated. I know where there are houses where people still speak it and so on, but the situation, Breton has evaporated, as did Irish in the 19th century, basically. It's following that It's following that pattern.
There is a revival, if I may barge in, a revival of the language of Britain in schools. There's a whole range of schools aiming to revive the language, Breton, if I'm right, of course. And we have the Celtic festival in early August every year. I've never been able to go there, but it's supposed to be a festival of all Celtic nations. So is there a sense of common culture, certainly, common identity, and a possible common future?
Not amongst people that I know. People that I know in Wales see themselves either as British or not, rather than Celtic or not. The people that I know in Ireland, there's a very strong national culture, a mediatized national culture in Ireland. So it's very Anglophone. Ireland is now an Anglophone, completely anglicized culture. Even people who speak Irish are part of that culture. In Scotland, what needs to be said about Scotland is that the language, the Scots Gaelic language, has disappeared from the mainland. There are no communities speaking Scots Gaelic on the mainland of Scotland anymore, and that's a process which started in 1745 with the Battle of Culloden, and then the clearances. So the Scotland now is emerging as an independent Anglophone or Scotophone. They have their own Scots language to nation, but the Gaelic culture is very peripheral there on the island. So numerically, they don't have a way to influence things. In Brittany, the schools, the Diwan schools and so on, they plateau out about 10,000. There are never more than about 10,000, which is, I'm not disparaging the number, but it's 10. It never exceeds 10,000 active pupils. So the population of Brittany being 2.5 million. There's some comments about the situation anyway.
Well,
last question, in a few words, do you expect a sort of rearrangement of economic ties between these nations under the current circumstances? I mean, do you expect Brittany and Ireland, for example, to have interconnections, I don't know, for energy, for gas, for goods, exchange of goods? Do you see anything of that happening? Of course, this is very, very, very recent, but do you feel something about these connections?